Today's Teisho will be on case 30 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 30 is entitled Joshu's A Big Radish. Main subject, a monk asked Joshu, "I have heard that you closely followed Nansen. Is that true?" Joshu said, "Chinshu produces a big radish." Secho's verse, "Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. They know only how it was and would be. How can they realize the swan is white, the crow is black?" Plunderer, plunderer. The monk had his nostrils threaded through. I was reading something in, I think it was Nature, and a scientist was saying that humans are actually giants in the natural world. And that's an odd statement because, of course, when we think of giants, we think of Tyrannosaurus rexes or elephants or blue whales. And humans might see themselves as small and vulnerable compared to a bear or a lion or a tiger. But actually, this scientist said that most life on Earth is quite a bit smaller than human beings. And so we have a particular perspective that's shaped by our size. Many, many things that could do us harm are so small that they're harmless to us. So if you get stung by a bee, unless you have an allergic reaction, it's not a major problem, or if you get a bitten by an ant. But he was making the point that for creatures that are the size of ants, an ant could be quite terrifying, or a spider. And that most of the life on Earth is around that size. I thought that was really a fascinating perspective on things. Basically, they said that humans tend to have a very rosy outlook on the natural world because we're not embroiled in the nitty-gritty. We're not down there with the ants trying to survive. I just thought that was so interesting. I think there's a great deal of truth to that. If you get to a certain size, you just don't have to worry. I think that's the message of the article, and that maybe part of the message of the article was that we have evolved to be a certain size so that we aren't really too threatened by our environment, and we have time to sit in the backyard and look at the clouds, or invent the alphabet, or learn how to ski, things like that, which we couldn't do if we were smaller because we'd just be too busy trying to survive. I think there's a lesson there. Naturally, almost everything I read I try to connect to Zen in some way, and of course I managed to connect this to Zen too. A lot of our problems, I think, are caused by having the wrong perspective on events. I had the chance when I was down in Virginia with my sister's family to meet some people who were quite a bit older than myself. They're people in their 70s and even their 80s. And these are people I've known, knew when I was much younger. And they had, I thought, a refreshingly, a relaxed perspective on things. At 80, you know, if you're not in a bad physical health, I think you see the world so much, differently, so differently. Because, you know, you're looking at it across this expanse of 70-some years, and what might have seemed quite important and quite earth-shattering at one point might now seem really inconsequential, unimportant. I can remember going to school at a York Elementary School in Baltimore, Maryland. And I was a very shy kid. And I was, like all children, anxious to be accepted and to be liked by my colleagues, by my fellow students. And I had talked my mother into buying a Zorro lunchbox. Back in these days, kids didn't necessarily buy lunch from the cafeteria. There was still like a tradition of thrift in our culture, and so lots of mothers packed lunches for their kids, and a lot of kids would bring their lunches in a metal box, you know, with snaps on it, and inside there would be a thermos. So you could have a thermos of milk, and you could have a sandwich and an apple, and this was just the beginning of television. Actually, television had been around for about 15 years. But it was really coming into its own, and basically, you know, shows like Zorro on TV were avidly watched by kids of my generation, kids born in the mid-50s. And I had to get a Zorro lunchbox because Zorro was the coolest person on television at that time. And I loved Zorro. I thought he was he was very mysterious. And so I had this lunchbox, and I didn't think consciously about it, but I probably thought that if I brought this lunchbox, people would like me, you know, because Zorro was cool. And anyway, I was proud of my lunchbox, and I did think it would be something that would be that people would like, and it would rub off on me. And I remember walking to my desk, and everybody started laughing as I had my lunchbox in my hand. I had gone to get it, and I walked back to my desk, and everybody started laughing. And I turned around, and my thermos was leaking, and I had left a trail of milk across the floor, which is really genuinely funny. But I was just so mortified. And the next day, I really didn't want to go to school. I was so humiliated by my experience of leaving a milk trail. It was so traumatic that I really begged my mother not to send me to school. It just seemed like the end of the earth, you know. The end of the world, I should say. And it was consequential. You know, it was really mattered to me. You know, I think when you're 80 years old and you look back at something like that, you just laugh because you have a bigger perspective. Sometimes old people are struggling. You know, they're not in good health or their faculties are declining. But these two people I know, these older women that I know, both are in really good health and their minds are quite sharp. And they had one of them has a real sense of humor. And I think that comes from being able to look back at things and realize that what seemed earth-shattering and really traumatic is genuinely traumatic, but nevertheless, it's a small thing, you know, in the scheme of things. And I think that perspective is really quite difficult to achieve. Maybe it takes 80 years, but it's quite liberating. Really quite liberating. My lunchbox, you know, seemed like the end of the world at that moment. And the next day, it took me a long time feel relaxed at lunch. A friend of mine has a son, a friend, the guy that I work with, Michael, has a son, Joey, who is, I don't know, he's in school now, and Michael's very concerned because Joey isn't eating his lunch. He went to the doctor. He took Joey to the doctor because Joey had gotten sick, and the doctor had Joey step on the scale. And even though Joey has gotten taller, he hasn't gained any weight. And this is something that Michael was concerned about. So it turns out Joey is not eating his sandwiches that he gets, and he takes his sandwiches to school, and he throws them in the trash. And Michael's trying to figure this out because he loves his son and he wants his son to be healthy. His son is losing weight or not gaining any weight, even though he's growing. And Michael is a little bit, you know, concerned. As a dad, he wants his son to be healthy and happy. And it's a big mystery as to why his son is throwing this stuff in the trash instead of eating it. And Michael asked him, he said, well, you know, why aren't you eating your sandwich? And his son said, food is just fuel, he said. I don't know what that means. I don't think Michael does either, you know. Michael's genuinely worried. You know, what does that mean? Food is fuel, you know. You know, is his son, maybe his son has Asperger's, you know, that I'm sure that's crossed his mind. Maybe so Michael's worried about it. You know, 50 years from now, or maybe 30 years from now, Michael will look back on this and he'll have a different perspective. You know, he has a bigger perspective. My sister has a little boy, her second boy. She had two boys quite late in life. She really wanted kids, and she didn't have her first son until she was 40, thanks to modern technology. And then she had her second son when she was 43, so she's going to be quite old before they're out of college. Her youngest son, first of all, both of these kids are addicted to computers. They get up in the morning and they immediately go onto their laptops. I really don't think it's healthy. And the youngest boy, Tristan is his name, gets very excited. When he gets very excited, he starts his hands start flapping like the flippers of a seal. It's very weird and a little bit scary, right? So he's a totally normal person. He's just like a normal little boy. But when he watches the computer, his eyes are fixed on the screen. And if he's playing a game, and they're always playing these games on the computer, he gets so excited he starts flapping. His hands are hanging by his side, but he starts flapping his hands like a seal. And it's very weird, and that could be a sign of Asperger's or autism even. He's clearly not autistic. And so when the school authorities saw this, they got very worried. And they called my sister, and my sister had a nervous breakdown thinking, oh my God, you know, my son is not neuronormal, as they say. And she was very worried. And then she went to her own doctor, an internist, and he said, "Oh, don't worry." He said, "I used to do that myself when I was a kid." And this guy is like a very talented man. He plays for the local symphony orchestra. He's a doctor. He has, you know. He said, "Oh yeah." He said, "I can't remember. There's a technical term, like it's not flapping, but." Something like that. And he said, "Oh, I was a flapper too when I was a kid." You know? And so it's all going to blow over, you know. So my sister's still uneasy because you know she doesn't want the authorities at school to do something that would be disadvantageous to her son. But you know, it all turns out to be he just gets excited and he starts flapping his hands. It is very, very weird. When I heard about it and then I saw it and I thought, that is the darndest thing. But I guess people can be flappers and they can still be cognitively normal. So, you know, someday my sister will, she's still anxious about this. You know, she stayed up all night, you know, when she got this call that he could be Asperger's. She was very, very worried. And because her second son had been conceived through, you know, the special hormone treatments and so on, she was really, you know, maybe felt guilty. What have I done? You know, it's this whole thing. I'm sure we've all had these experiences where something happens and it just seems like the end of the world, you know. And you toss and turn at night and you think, oh my God, you know. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you look back on it and it's, what was that all? What was I upset about again? You know, and there's a kind of natural process of forgetting, I think. But I also think that we get a distance on the event, and we realize it's not as important as we thought, you know. And this can happen to whole societies. You know, I was reading about the trials in Cambodia. And for the last 30 years, the United Nations has been trying to put on trial all of the criminals, the really terrible, monstrous people who committed, you know, basically what we might call a genocide in Cambodia and killed millions of their fellow countrymen. The reporter who was covering this story was really surprised because he said nobody in Cambodia really seems very enthusiastic about the trial. And he kept talking to people who said, well, you know, I really think we should, you know, these people are powerless now. Some of them are in jail. We really should just move on. And I thought that was such a strange response. But a few years back, I had read something about Cambodian children and how they had adapted to the traumas that they had gone through. And the psychologists who studied them were really surprised to see how well these kids had handled all this trauma. And the article didn't really know why, but basically the Cambodian kids did a lot better than the psychologist imagined they would. You know, they somehow were able to go on move forward in their lives. You know, without being terribly, terribly crippled by these horrible, nightmarish events. I do myself think that all of these people in the Khmer Rouge should definitely stand trial. And it's possible that some people saying, let's just forget about it, are trying to just bury their heads in the sand. But some of the people who were interviewed in the article clearly thought these were bad guys and that they should be punished. But one of the things the reporter emphasized was a lot of these people, one of the things the reporter emphasized was that a lot of these people did not seem angry. And I think they're not angry because it's 30 years later. And I think that they have a different perspective on things. They're much more interested in moving into a better life, you know, in creating a better society. That was something people said again and again. That what we really want now is a better tomorrow, you know. I think that that's important, you know. We all have these experiences that just seem absolutely traumatic. And yet, you know, somehow 2 weeks later, or a month later, or 10 years later, we look back at them and we see them as though at a different scale. So now they're part of a larger sequence of events, and we can see the whole sequence of events. And in that context, what seemed like the Matterhorn of suffering turns out to be a molehill, you know. I'm not saying it wasn't important at the time, but having that perspective can be very liberating. You know, sometimes when we're really in distress, when we're really suffering, one key element of our suffering is the idea that there's no resolution, that there will be no resolution. I was reading the other day that something like 10% of the American population suffers, is currently being treated for depression. That was a fascinating statistic. But the other statistic that I thought was even more interesting is that the health professionals say it's probably three times higher. A number of people in my family suffered from depression. I think in retrospect, I realized my mother did. And I think before I started doing Zen, I was suffering from depression myself. And one of the elements of depression that's especially difficult to cope with is this conviction that there's no exit, that there's no, this is just going to go on and on forever. And I think depressed people have a very hard time seeing the exit, you know, seeing the this too shall pass, that kind of thing. I think this problem of suffering is really a problem sometimes of perspective. And naturally, as you might suspect, I'm going to bring this around to Zen. You know, I do think that in Zen we learn how to cultivate a different perspective. You know, we identify very, very closely with the I, right? With the part of ourselves that's thinking from the first-person standpoint. And we regard this as our true self, right? I mean, what other... I was talking to a psychologist about a year ago who didn't know anything about Zen. And she was asking me, she said, well, is there a theory of personality development in Buddhism? And I said, I don't think so, no. And she said, do you have a... you know, do you have a concept of, you know, personal psychology? And I said, no, I don't think so. You know, and I said, but we're interested in a different self. And she started laughing. She said, what other self is there? And I just, you know, I just retreated from the conversation. I give up, you know. But you know, if she had been more sympathetic as a partner in conversation, what I would have said is that Zen is all about the Zen starts from the experience of a different self, you know. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we meditate, what happens to people, it won't happen in half an hour, but what it might happen if you start meditating early and then you go for a couple sits, maybe two or three or maybe five. What you begin to notice is that your consciousness is no longer anchored to the same degree in that personal self. It's like the I is real, it's a part of you, it's a part of your consciousness. But as you sit on the cushion for, say, half an hour, and then another half an hour, and then another half an hour, it's a subtle shift, but you begin to notice that you're no longer perceiving from the standpoint of that personal self, that thinking self, that me-referencing self. You'll notice there's a kind of loosening up in your awareness. it's like loosening up, that's the best way to put it, or like, you know, people say expanded awareness, and that's not such a bad word. But you think, what is getting expanded here? And what's getting expanded is you're moving from the very, very tight, the very tightly limited consciousness of the I outward into this sort of formless, groundless, roving consciousness. You know, ungrounded consciousness, uncentered consciousness. And when we enter that consciousness, we often feel very good. You might feel blissful or even disembodied. You might feel like you're floating. You might feel like you're expanding. You might just feel good. You know, you might just feel pleasant. This is a very subtle shift, but if you observe it carefully, what's happening is that you're moving from, you know, to be in the self is actually like very, very claustrophobic. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have a self. You know, I think it's very important to be knowledgeable about ourselves, especially about the mental games we play with ourselves. You know, if we tend to be insecure, it's good to see that and know that that's part of our apparatus. If we have a certain undercurrent of self-loathing, that's part of the apparatus. If you are sort of like needy emotionally sometimes when you're insecure, that's part of the apparatus, and it's good to know about that. So having that kind of self-knowledge is actually quite good, quite important. But nevertheless, this being in the self can be quite claustrophobic, quite limiting, and often it doesn't bring out the best in people. You know, it's sometimes very difficult to be creative, imaginative, risk-taking, compassionate, experimental, when you're in that self. That self has the tendency, has the characteristic of being rather beleaguered, sometimes being rather nervous, defensive, and so on. So it's difficult to be generous and open-ended when you're in that small self. And when you sit on the cushion for a couple hours, even if you're not consciously aware of it, there's a shift in your consciousness. You know? And it's no longer anchored so narrowly in that the confines of the self, and now there's a kind of free-floating awareness. And it's very pleasant, you know. So when you hear the sound of the fan blowing overhead, you don't necessarily reference yourself. You're just sort of becoming one with the sound of the fan. And this is really quite important. And then maybe if you're sitting outside, you know, you're sitting in your own house, you might hear a car go by, or you might hear a bird, you know, or you might hear the rain. And you're not referencing yourself when you do this. You're just becoming one with the sound of the rain, or becoming one with the sound of the bird. As I say, it's quite important to develop yourself, to have self-knowledge, to become mature. It's very important to take care of yourself, you know, and respect yourself. And that there's a whole process which, say, therapy is engaged with, or psychology is engaged with, identity formation, things like, you know, mechanisms like repression and so on. All of this is part of the creation of the self and its difficulties and so on. So I'm not saying those things aren't important. It's important to go through normal maturation. So it's important to have friends in college. It's important to have friends after you graduate. It's important to do things with other people, to learn how to be a person, to learn how to be a friend, to learn how to be a lover, to learn whatever. To learn how to be a husband or a wife. So those are important, but not everything. And sometimes it can be imprisoning, you know, to just be I, to just be me. And there's more to consciousness than that. And when we step outside of that small mind, we say, you know, you have this wonderful, unanchored, untethered, free-floating consciousness. And it becomes very readily able to become one with things around it, you know. So when you're in samadhi, when you're in deep samadhi and you hear sounds, you know, they just seem very clear and very pure. Or after an evening of meditation, you have a cup of tea and it just seems absolutely delicious. This is because this untethered, unboxed-in consciousness is very ready, able, and willing to fuse with things around it. Maybe because it's already one in a way that the small mind can't appreciate. But this already oneness is really essential to what we call Zen mind. So if you sit for half an hour a day, you probably don't have the experience of this Zen mind. But you do have a deep relaxation experience, which is very important, and you probably have about 10 minutes of moving towards this deeper mind. If you sit for an hour or two, and we don't always have time to do that. I appreciate that. But when you do have a chance to sit on the cushion for a couple hours, after like the first hour, you've kind of run through all the usual bullshit associated with the self, right? So you sit down on the cushion and you're saying, you know, oh my God, you know, it's the end of the world, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you go looping around and around and around. And the more you think about this, the more anxious you become, you know, or the more angry you become, or the more fearful you become. And this goes on and on. The bell rings. And the first sit is over. And then you start the next sit, and there you are. I do this too. You know, I'm looping back. Oh no, you know, why did he say that? What's he going to do next? You know, oh my God, you know, I could lose my job, you know, whatever. You know. And you go around and around and around. And then the bell rings again. And you get up and you go to the bathroom, and you walk to the bathroom. Now, strangely, you're not thinking so much, you know. And you might notice maybe you go into the bathroom and you use the urinal, and you notice that the sound is kind of interesting, you know. And then you flush, and that's an interesting sound. Then you come back and you're back to the cushion. And now that those loops seem, they're sort of like in the background, or they have disappeared, and you're in this ambient consciousness. And I don't know about you, but I experience that as very liberating. I can be quite, you know, earlier I said that people who are depressed feel that their situation is interminable. And I remember that. But actually, that's a function of the way the depressive mind works, right? Which is to loop around and around and around in this obsessive way. So the interminability, you know, the sense of interminability is sort of created by the thinking style of the small self, actually, you know. So anyway, it's very healthy and liberating to get outside the small self and begin to just float around the room, you know, and connect with things. It's just very healing, very beautiful. And sometimes you can get off the cushion and you can be laughing. You know, you can actually just find yourself laughing, even though you're still troubled by this problem that you brought to the cushion to begin with. Going through this process, by the way, of leaving the small self and entering this more expansive, ungrounded awareness is the essence of Zen practice. You do that 1,000 times, and maybe you have a little different attitude towards your problems. Although not always, I must confess. But you know, for one thing, you see there is a way out. right? There is a way out of this. I can resolve this issue. I might not be able to solve my problem of having a co-worker with whom I don't get along. That may be an unsolvable problem right now. But I might be able to get out of feeling trapped by it by being able to sit down on the cushion and enter this bigger mind. And in that bigger mind, you know, sometimes ideas occur to you that you're just too tense to come up with when you're in the small mind. Sometimes you get out of that, you know, that claustrophobic, the small self, especially when it's worried or fearful, is very claustrophobic. It's a very tight, intense place to be. And when you get out of that and you're in this other, more expansive mind, you know, there's like breathing room. And it's like now, you can think of something new because you're not every moment of your consciousness is not being devoted to being afraid or rehearsing the events that are causing you so much anxiety or fantasizing about how things can go wrong. So suddenly it's like a weight is off your shoulders and you're now able to breathe freely. And in this state, all kinds of good things can occur to you, you know, and different patterns of action are possible in that state. So I would say that Zen is really quite valuable in this way. But there's something else you might notice about events when you have this, when you're in this other perspective, you know. One of the claims that Buddhism makes about reality is that it is a self-organizing system. And that it's made up of cycles of decay and renewal. This is like a Buddhist view of the world. And basically, everything changes. You know, when Suzuki Roshi, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is the best-selling Zen book of all times. He was once asked to sum up Buddhism. He said, what's the essence of Zen, I guess he was asked. And he said, everything changes. And naturally, when things change, if we're in pain and things change, that could be a good thing. When we're happy and things are changing, that could be threatening, right? Because the world we know and value is slipping away. But Buddhism says, look, you know, if you observe events as they unfold, if you're in deep samadhi and you just watch the moments come and go, you'll notice that there is that this process of coming and going is ceaseless. And also, every moment comes into the world very fresh and new. Every moment. So actually, consciousness feels sometimes like a stream. So you have a thought and a perception, and a thought and a perception, and a sensation, etc., etc. But actually, if you really do a lot of meditation and you slow it down, you notice the moment of perception, and you can really only be aware, believe it or not, of one thing at a time. Maybe psychologists will say that's not true, but my experience is that you can really only be aware of one thing at each instant. And basically, each moment of awareness as it arises is very fresh and new. And then it begins to solidify, and then it begins to fall apart. So you could spend several years practicing listening. And you could listen to the sound of birds, or you could listen to the sound of crickets, or you could listen to the sound of cars going by. And if you listen very, very carefully, and you're in deep samadhi, and you do this for about 9 hours a day, you'll notice that basically in the initial part of any moment is very fresh and clear, and there's no thoughts in your head. And then the moment becomes more rigid and thoughts arise, and then it decays and it falls apart. There's a real rhythm to moment coming and falling apart, coming and falling apart. This is something you can actually experience if you're a quite practiced meditator and you're in deep concentration. And it's also like standard Buddhist teaching. Every moment is coming into being and then solidifying and then falling apart. And I think this is actually characteristic of everything we know, that it arises, it comes into a sort of like a full form, fully realized form, and then it begins to fall apart. And when it falls apart, you know, we have all kinds of anxious reactions, right? You know, because we don't have faith in the process. Maybe faith is not the right word, but we don't have trust in the process. You know, Buddhism is not theocentric. You know, it's not a theistic belief system. But people who believe in God, you know, often are able to achieve great peace of mind because they say, well, you know, I know it's in His hands and He wouldn't do anything to hurt me. Well, Buddhism isn't theistic, but it actually has it has the same perspective, which is even though things are falling apart in a way that seems terrible or uncontrollable, everything is falling apart, and that basically there's a kind of self-organizing process. Things fall apart, and then they are things sort of like reassemble, or the moment comes, and then it falls apart, and then another fresh moment comes. You know, when the moment falls apart, we become fixated. We can become fixated, and it seems like we'll never get out of that situation. It's like we'll never be able to get out of the current deterioration of our circumstances. And of course, then all kinds of negative thinking begin, and we can get very powerful negative emotional reactions. But if you spend a lot of time on the cushion, if you haven't been asleep, you might have noticed that the moment goes away, but then another moment comes, and the moment goes away, and another moment comes, and the dissolution of moment by moment is inescapable. But there's always this other thing that arises that's fresh and new. And if you aren't sleeping on the cushion and you've paid some attention, you begin to develop a kind of intuitive trust in the process of the self-renewing process of the universe. Another way to put it is things have a way of working out. So, I think that people who are 80 years old and who are have their faculties intact, and they look back over their lives, they kind of understand that things have a way of working out. They don't necessarily work out the way we want them to work out, which is very difficult to deal with, you know. But they have a way of working out. And there is always a kind of wholeness or kind of beautiful completeness to the moment as it arises. And that one way to avoid going crazy in life is to harmonize yourself with that oneness as it arises, and then harmonize yourself with events as they unravel, knowing, trusting that things are going to be, on the other end of this process, something good is coming. So in this koan, finally to get to the koan, a monk, Joshu, was a student of Master Nansen. And Joshu studied with Nansen for maybe almost 40 years, 30 years, something like that. And then Nansen died, and Joshu was himself quite old. And everybody thought Joshu was going to set up shop and teach Zen at Nansen's temple, but he didn't. He hit the road, and he went all over the country. meeting teachers and testing his insight against their insight, and so on. Apparently, at one temple he went to visit, somebody basically said, "I hear you come from Nansen. I hear you come from Nansen's temple, and you're the great Joshu, basically, and you're supposed to have some special insight, you know. What is it that makes you so special, Mr. Joshu?" So it's really kind of like a taunt. You know, people really worship the Dalai Lama, especially Westerners, because he's not like them. I have known Westerners who are really deeply enlightened, you know, who have been treated with some contempt by other Westerners, because there's a kind of jealousy there sometimes, or competitiveness, if I'm making any sense. So if you meet the Dalai Lama and you're a Westerner, you might say, "Oh, Your Holiness, you know, you're the embodiment of enlightenment," and so on. But then you might meet a Western person and you might say, "Well, who the hell do you think you are?" See? You know, basically there's a kind of jealousy there. Well, this is sort of the thing that Joshu is getting from this person. The person's saying, "So you're the great Joshu. What makes you so gosh darn great?" See? And Joshu says, in Chinshu, and he was from Chinshu, he says, "In Philadelphia, they make a big cheesesteak." He says, "In Chinshu, they grow a big radish." See? And Joshu's saying, "This is my practice. This is how I practice." See? It's possible to get caught in a box. You know, it's possible to get trapped in a box, you know. Reality only once in a while conforms to what we think. Usually, good things are not exactly what we expect, right? I mean, that's usually the case. And reality generally is unpredictable to some degree. So probably 2 years ago, if you had said, "I will be here at this point," probably you couldn't have predicted 2 years ago where you are today. You might have been in the ballpark, but not precisely. So reality has this unpredictability. And Joshu says, I'm able to embrace that openness in things, right? And I'm able to trust in that openness. So the guy says, "What's so special about you, Mr. Joshu?" And he says, "I trust that openness." In Chinshu, there's a big radish. How big? It's always bigger than you think. See, it's always bigger than you think. So, I mean, one of our biggest problems, and it's my problem too, it's everybody's problem, is that we form a mental picture of our situation based upon our immediate circumstances. We can't really see the future, right? We can't. And we imagine our present condition to be interminable, and it's going to repeat exactly as it is forever. But old people, for example, they see, it's not like that. You know, basically, one day you're in Philadelphia and the next day you're in New Jersey. You know, things are always changing. As these changes are happening, we can be very, very anxious and fearful, or we can be open to the possibilities, you know, and maybe even if we're not in our small self, it's possible to feel pretty good about being alive because we are not clinging to the way things have been, but we're allowing them to unfold in the trust that everything is going to work out. Right? So it worked for Joshu. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, "I have heard that you closely followed Nansen. Is that true? Joshu said, Chinshu produces a big radish. Secho's verse, Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. They know only how it was and would be. How can they realize the swan is white, the crow is black? Plunderer, plunderer. The monk had his nostrils threaded through. So, you know, we extrapolate from our current situation in ways that don't allow us to see the real openness, the possibilities of every moment. We all do this. But one of the crucial functions of Zazen is to leave that small self and enter this larger ambient consciousness. And you look around and you suddenly go, oh, this, I can work with this. Just not in the way I thought. To stay in the consciousness that wants everything to be unchanging is to be constantly in pain, even though we sometimes can't help doing that. But to be in this other consciousness is really to make a change your ally and friend, and that means making life your ally and friend. So I hope you'll do it.